Penguin Random House Audio presents Out of Office, The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home by Charlie Worzel and Anne Helen Peterson. This is the author, Charlie Worzel. Introduction. Whatever you were doing during the pandemic and its stilted aftermath, it was not working from home. Bullshit, you might say, remembering all those times you sat in a makeshift office in your bedroom, haphazardly constructed so that it might look semi-professional over Zoom calls. If you're one of the roughly 42% of Americans who are able to work remotely during the pandemic, you likely spent most of the time chained to a screen in your home, clocking in each morning. You were, quite literally, doing your job from home. But you weren't working from home. You were laboring in confinement and under duress. Others have described it as living at work. You were frantically tapping out an email while trying to make lunch and supervise distance learning. You were stuck alone in a cramped apartment for weeks, unable to see friends or family, exhausted, and managing a level of stress you didn't know was possible. Work became life, and life became work. You weren't thriving. You were surviving. Here's the nightmare scenario. This could be the remote future. Until recently, broad implementation of work from home seemed more like a thought experiment in the pages of Harvard Business Review than an idea that might work in practice. But the pandemic forced millions into remote work, and companies got curious. For a CFO, the prospect of getting that expensive downtown real estate off the balance sheet is enticing, especially if you factor in cost of living decreases when employees move out of high-cost cities. And then there's the efficiency. No more commutes means more time to answer emails. Some of the biggest companies in the world have already made remote work an option for the foreseeable future, which, as with almost any business decision, means they think it would be good for the bottom line. And their cost savings will be shouldered by you. This is the dark truth of remote work as we know it now. It promises to liberate workers from the chains of the office, but in practice, it capitalizes on the total collapse of work-life balance. We know this from experience. In 2017, we made the case that we could do our jobs as reporters even better from outside the city. We packed our car in Brooklyn and made the transition to working from home in Montana after more than a decade of office life. And more organized, a bit more introverted by nature, settled right in. Before journalism, she'd been an academic and a professor. Going to the office always felt weirder, more compulsory, than working from your kitchen table. But the flexibility of academic life, and now journalistic life, really just meant flexibility to work all the time. Dreams of daily hikes in the mountains quickly evaporated. She was working just as much, if not more, than she did in New York. The backdrop was just more beautiful. I love to bullshit with people in the office. I can't manage my calendar to save my life. I thrive on interaction. And I struggled immediately. The first few months were disorienting and grueling. I spent so much time frantically writing, emailing, and staying in constant contact via Slack messages from the couch that, when I'd sit back down at night to unwind, I'd break into a cold sweat. Working relentlessly from home crossed my wires. My mind and body were unable to understand why I was both at the office and mainlining Netflix. I was absolutely convinced the move would hurt my career. I'd be isolated, invisible to superiors, and overlooked for assignments. I worried I was becoming untethered from my work, that I'd lost those spontaneous encounters and conversations that sparked new ideas. So I worked obsessively, with my bosses reaping the rewards even if they didn't know it. Work on weekends? Why not? After all, I was already at the office. No commute didn't mean free time in the mornings and evenings. It meant rolling out of bed and grabbing the phone and punching the clock. I was writing more than ever, but I started burning out every few weeks, desperate for any activity that would help demarcate work from leisure. Something had to change. In order to make working from home sustainable years before the pandemic hit, We had to figure out a way to cultivate a rich home life and then fit our jobs into that space, not the other way around. That meant disconnecting more, but it also meant changing the rhythms of our days and doing away with the rigidity beaten into us by the modern workplace. Once we made those changes, the lesson was immediately clear. Offices can be bullies. They force us to orient our days around commutes. They commandeer our attention with, sometimes enjoyable, unscheduled drive-by meetings. They elevate the feeling of productivity over being productive. They're a breeding ground for microaggressions and toxic loops of hierarchical behavior. It's no surprise that people who thrive in the office are almost always the same people who've accumulated or were raised with a lot of identity-related privilege outside of it. Working from home can be a meaningful act of control and resistance, but it's also not a cure-all. It can't promise to fix the rot at the core of modern capitalism. All of the toxic dynamics listed before can be ported over to the remote work world. This is especially true if you or your company conceives of working from home as everything that used to happen in the office, only now you're the one paying rent and utilities. The goal of this book, then, is to think through how we can liberate ourselves from the most toxic, alienating, and frustrating aspects of office work. Not just by shifting the location where the work is completed, but also by rethinking the work we do and the time that we allot to it. This book isn't a how-to manual. It isn't self-help, at least not in the traditional way we think of it. We don't profess to have anything figured out. Balancing work and life continues to be a struggle for us, and we fail all the time, in part because we do find satisfaction in our jobs. This book is also specifically focused and addressed to the 42% of workers whose jobs can be done remotely, far from universal. But for that 42% and growing, we're trying to figure out what's broken about the thing that takes up so much of our waking hours and begin to try to fix it. Which is why we think of this book as more of a roadmap. It'll show you how we got to our current broken relationship with work and the routes we can take from here. We can double back, reproducing the same soul-sucking, exploitative office dynamics as before, only doing it from home. Individuals can forge their own path off the main road, as they have for years, struggling to maintain balance in the face of corporate norms. Those with the confidence and privilege to go remote on their terms will reap the benefits, while others will become second-class office citizens. Or we can take a third route, in which the workday itself and the expectations of workers are reconceptualized. That doesn't just mean implementing Zoom happy hours or making a company-wide announcement that it's okay if your kids pop into the conference call to ask for a snack. That's the sort of incrementalism that fixes nothing and exhausts everyone. Reconceptualization means having honest conversations about how much people are working and how they think they could work better, not longer. Not by taking on more projects or being better delegators or having more meetings. Not by creating more value for their employer at the expense of their mental and physical health. Instead, it means acknowledging that better work is, in fact, oftentimes less work over fewer hours, which makes people happier, more creative, more invested in the work they do and the people they do it for. It entails thinking through how online communication tools function as surveillance and incentivize play-acting your job instead of actually doing it. It will require organization based on employees' and managers' preferred and most effective work times, and consideration of child and elder care responsibilities, volunteering schedules, and time zones. There's no easy endgame. There are no actionable checklists at the end of each chapter. The process is difficult and, if we're being honest, never-ending. But we are at a societal inflection point. Part of our lives that were once quietly annoying have become intolerable. Social institutions that have long felt broken are now actively breaking us. So many things we've accepted as norms, from public health practices to public school schedules, have the potential to change. In the absence of visionary governmental leadership, the impetus for change has increasingly fallen on the individual. but from individuals were also watching movements set in motion, rooted in fairness, equality, and racial and economic justice. The policy proposals guiding these movements are ambitious, and the particulars can feel complex. But the ideas behind them are elegant in their simplicity. When an institution is broken, it can't be reformed with incremental fixes that touch the contours of the problem but don't probe the heart. They must be reimagined, not in some utopian fashion, but with a vigilant eye towards how power is accumulated and distributed. This work will be difficult and different for each company. It might, at least in the beginning, feel radical. Capitalism is inherently exploitative, but it is also, at least for the immediate future, our guiding economic system. If we're going to live under it, can we bend it to make that experience involve less suffering? Not only for office workers, but also for our immediate families, the societies we share, and the rest of the working world. The thesis of this book is that remote work, not remote work during a pandemic, not remote work under duress, can change your life. It can remove you from the wheel of constant productivity. It can make you happier and healthier, but it can also make your community happier and healthier. It can make the labor in your home more equitable and can help you be a better friend and parent and partner. It can, somewhat ironically, actually increase worker solidarity. It can allow you to actually live the sort of life you pretend to live in your Instagram posts, liberating you to explore the non-work corners of your life, from actual hobbies to civic involvement. And it doesn't have to be full-time remote work either. No one is suggesting that we're completely done with offices. As J.P. Morgan's chief operating officer put it in February 2021, going back to the office with 100% of the people, 100% of the time, I think there is zero chance of that. As for everyone working from home all the time, there is also zero chance of that. For most people, traditional office space will commingle in some form with co-working spaces, coffee shops, our friends' kitchen tables, and our own home setups. Whatever your isolating, claustrophobic setup was during the pandemic, that is not what the future of work looks like. We see a real chance to repair our relationship to work, something that's deeply broken, particularly here in America, but increasingly in other countries as well. Work, which has long been a source of inspiration, dignity, and the cherished prospect of upward mobility, has stagnated and trapped us. We don't mean to sound revisionist. That same work was also intermittently miserable. But for so many so-called knowledge workers, it's become an identity above all else, slowly eroding the other parts that make a rich, well-rounded human existence. The good news is we can change that, but only if we commit ourselves to refiguring the place of work in our lives. Right now, our priorities are backwards. Instead of changing our lives to make ourselves better workers, we have to change our work to make our lives better. To get at that potential for change, we've arranged the book around four overarching concepts. For each, we'll explore its shape leading up to the pandemic, what was breaking or long broken, and how remote work could shift, exacerbate, or, most optimistically, begin to mend existing problems moving forward. Flexibility. For the last 40 years, business books, financial publications, and industry leaders have fetishized the idea of corporate flexibility. The obsession with nimble companies should theoretically imply a similar obsession with accommodation of different schedules, different work styles, different locales. Instead, flexibility has been a code word for a company's ability to rapidly hire and lay off employees as needed. It's gradually become the guiding justification of the freelance and contract economy, which beguiled employees with the promise of unshackling them from the constraints of a traditional 9-to-5 job. The benefits of the flexible economy have flowed almost entirely to corporations as workers grapple with unprecedented levels of instability in the workplace. Contingent workers can adapt their schedules to fit their needs, but they're also always in search of the next job, always wondering if they're working enough, always striving for something approximating the security of a full-time office job, instead of the precarious, ever-shifting gig. The future of office work has to be guided by a new, genuine form of flexibility, in which the work, not the workers themselves, becomes even more malleable. Genuine flexibility is the linchpin of this work renovation project. Without it, you can't meaningfully shift work culture, your relationship to technology, or your dedication to your community. Free workers from their arbitrary schedules, and you create space for all sorts of changes in our experience of everyday work, in our capacity to do our jobs, in our relationships with the people who make life worth living. What does genuine flexibility look like in practice? It means reconceiving what sort of tasks and collaborations need to be synchronous, and what can actually be done asynchronously, and how many days we'd like people to be in an office, and for how long, and for what purpose. It includes broadening job descriptions to better meet the time and location needs of people who are disabled and juggling caregiving duties. And it will require the implementation of actual respected boundaries to ensure that quote-unquote flexible work doesn't spread into all corners of the calendar. Culture. There's how an organization defines itself publicly, and then there's how employees experience life within that organization on a daily basis. Somewhere in the space between those two understandings is company culture, which, once in place, can be incredibly difficult to change, save through something as dramatic as, well, a paradigm-shifting pandemic. We'll look at how companies conceive of themselves as a clubhouse, a group of hustlers, a collection of workaholics, a bunch of inflexible but reliable traditionalists, and, most commonly, a family. And what standards of behavior, exploitation, waste, productivity, hierarchies, respect or lack thereof, flow from them. When an office goes fully or partially remote, there's a potential to retrench existing culture, largely born out of fear. Companies implement more meetings and micromanagerial communication in an attempt to preserve existing hierarchies. But management for management's sake isn't skilled management, something the pandemic year has made abundantly clear. You can shift company culture, but it has to start not just with the CEO or individual workers, but with a dramatic rethinking of what management actually looks like in and outside the traditional office. If your company culture is not just theoretically good or good for management, but actually good, it'll still require planning and diligence to figure out how to integrate more flexible work. And if it's toxic, flexible work won't fix it. But it might provide the window to start rethinking what that culture might be moving forward. Technologies of the office. We often think of office technology in terms of our digital devices, our computers, our smartphones, and the programs and apps that run on them. But so much of office culture flows from the technology of design, which includes everything from the physical architecture that arranges workers within a building, to the digital architecture that determines when and how you interact with your Slack messages. So much office tech, from the dreaded open office plan to business email, was designed with utopian hopes, only to collide with the corporate imperatives and devolve slowly to make work so much worse. Same for the cool Silicon Valley campus, the Aeron chair, and Google Calendar. The cool stuff intended to solve problems created new ones, more massive and nightmarish than its creators could have ever imagined. The question, then, is how do we break our current reliance on tech and design that creates more and more mind-numbing work? How do we reframe our technology away from the vague but ruthless notion of productivity? How do we create spaces for in-person work that adapt to more flexible use, but don't feel like alienating anonymous work hotels? These are challenges that demand more strategy than Inbox Zero, more vision than a behemoth like WeWork, and more nuance than tools that equate time working with time that your cursor is moving. It is here, in our technology, tools, and design, that we can see the most profound changes the quickest. Changing the way we communicate about our work and variability in the spaces we do it
can transform our daily schedules and reshape the contours of our days. In the past, office tech and design have been oriented toward figuring out how to compel employees to spend more time at work and/or working. Now the task is to use them to help us do the opposite. Community. What would you do if you had more control of your life? Would you start each day with a walk? Would you finally establish that exercise routine? What about picking up new hobbies? What's stopping you right now? Turns out, it's your job. Work will always be a major part of our lives. What we're suggesting, however, is that it should cease to be the primary organizing factor within it, the primary source of friendship or personal worth or community. Because when work envelops our lives, our intimate community shoulders the consequences. We give and receive less care, less intentionality, less communication. But genuinely flexible work and the decentering of our jobs that accompanies it can liberate us to recultivate and restructure our relationships with ourselves and our community. Sure, you might not be as close with your colleagues, but if you have other areas of your life that will make you feel loved, understood, valued, and essential, will it matter? In practice, this decentering might free up time to actually equalize the distribution of labor in the home. It could allow you to figure out what you actually like to do in your spare time, when that time is not consumed with recovering from the sheer amount of work you're doing. It might mean figuring out an elder or childcare scenario that feels less frazzling. It can't mean even more multitasking, more hats to wear when you're in the home, more pressure to be everything to everyone. When work becomes truly flexible to our needs, that's when we're able to carve out meaningful, consistent, nourishing space from our days. For ourselves, but also for the people who make this life worth living. And that means connecting with your greater community as well. Before the pandemic, our nation had arrived at one of the lowest rates of social cohesion in modern history. We're less invested and have less trust in each other. We're less willing to sacrifice for people we don't know. We're far more focused on the fate of the individual, on me and mine, than the fate of a societal whole. When our livelihoods feel threatened and precarious, we tend to behave as we're taught during moments of crisis. Place the oxygen mask on yourself first before helping others around you. There are myriad reasons for this decline in social cohesion, most of them connected to unfettered capitalism, scarcity, and a general refusal to authentically address profound, enduring race and gender-based inequalities. But as knowledge workers, we've both contributed to and reacted to this decline by working more. This strategy sometimes results in a marginally more stable income, but it also leads to alienation, loneliness, and markedly decreased feelings of belonging. When we work all the time, we volunteer less. We spend less time hanging out with people who are and aren't like us. We might love the place that we live, but we don't manifest that affection through actual involvement. Flexible work, done right, means working less and directing far more time, investment, and intention into the greater community. In practice, that means more than just having time to volunteer for the library board. It's making sure that the library board isn't just made up of people like you. It's more than signing up for the local CSA. It's devoting the time to figuring out solutions to food insecurity in your community. It's about finding time for yourself, and then, once you've found it, using some of that time to make life better for everyone around you. Which is why we'll also think about how a shift to genuinely flexible work can have meaningful effects on city planning, on public and private gathering spaces, and on ideas about everything from childcare to worker solidarity. Cities contract and expand all the time. But how do we resist the sort of transformation that limits reliable access to public transit, well-funded schools, and sources for fresh food? How do small cities and towns adjust to an influx of high-wage workers while local wages remain low? What plans need to be put in place, both on the governmental and corporate level, to actively combat even further stratification between those who can control the rhythms of their work and those who cannot? The future health of the greater community demands we pay attention to these questions now. Because in the end, all of these changes will feel superficial and hollow if the community that surrounds you is suffering. Knowledge work, the primary type of work that's done remotely, is ultimately privileged work. And the problems therein are, at times, gilded ones. Few people struggling with working from home are also struggling to get food on the table. If the pandemic has shown us anything, it's that the compass that guides our ability to identify and reward essential work has been uncalibrated. Our obsession with productivity has distracted us from systemic inequalities, swallowing the sort of time and energy necessary to advocate for change. One of the refrains of the current moment is, quote, "I don't know how to make you care about other people." And one of the most straightforward solutions could be giving people the time and mental freedom to actually care about things that aren't themselves and their immediate families. And then there's the secondary possibility of a wholesale shift in what and whom we value. If we shift our focus from relentless productivity, we may collectively rethink our societal metrics for success. A society obsessed with shareholder value, GDP, and corporate wealth creation will value and reward those who drive those metrics upward. Bankers, venture capitalists, day traders. A society obsessed with quality of life, care, and societal health values rewards a very different set of people. Before and during the pandemic, our most essential workers struggled to receive equitable pay and adequate protections, precisely because their work wasn't valued. But what if it was? And what if one of the key steps to getting there was for non-essential workers, like us, to change the way we see ourselves? For years, many of us have behaved as if our jobs trump everything else in our lives. We're loath to say it out loud, but our actions tell the true story. We value our work performance over our families, over personal growth and health, and over our communities. Part of that commitment is rooted in fear of instability. But part of it, too, stems from the ways in which we've convinced ourselves that our work is important in order to justify how much of ourselves and how many years and hours we've devoted to it. That sort of emotional devotion makes it harder to think of work as what it is. Not a savior, not a family, but a job. It also makes it harder to organize or demand better conditions for other employees in your workplace and in others. It's paradoxical, but the ability to decenter work in your life and separate it, however slightly, from your identity actually makes you a better advocate for other workers. Done wrong, flexible work will only exacerbate the class divide, further separating the actual essential workers from those who can labor from the safety of their homes. That's where we're headed if we don't make meaningful changes in the way we conceive of our labor and in the way that we advocate for others. But a deliberately conceived, flexible future could also do something remarkable. It could liberate us in meaningful and lasting ways from work. We don't work from home because work is what matters most. We work from home to free ourselves to focus on what actually does.